This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Welcome to episode number 4 of the Beersmith Show. We've got a great interview today with Dr. Chris White, who is the president of White Labs Yeast. I'd like to thank you for listening out there. First three episodes, we crossed 10,000 downloads, which is just absolutely incredible. And it's really great to have so many of you listening out there today. We've got some outstanding guests lined up in the near future, including author Drew Beecham. I've got BJCP Grandmaster Gordon Strong coming, and also Dr. Charlie Bamforth, one of the country's top brewing scientists. So we're looking forward to that. I'd like to thank you also for supporting my new book, Home Brewing with Beersmith. It's on Amazon, and Amazon has the book on sale right now, and it's slowly climbing the charts on Amazon. Thanks again to all of you. And without further ado, I'm going to jump into this week's interview. I'm incredibly happy to have Dr. Chris White from whitelabs.com here. And Chris has written a new book. It's called Yeast: The Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation, and that came out last month, and I'm looking forward to getting my own copy of that here shortly. But Chris, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's nice to finally be here. We've talked a lot about in emails about being on the show.
So you're on the road a lot, I noticed.
Yep. I'm in town. I'm at home about 5 or 10 days a month.
Wow. Well, I'm glad to catch you here, and I'm glad to have you had time to come in and visit with us.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask, first, you and I started about the same time. How did you get started in home brewing?
Well, I went to college at UC Davis. That's where I'm doing the interview now from, Davis. But I went to Davis for a bachelor's degree in biochemistry, and I started home brewing while I was here. I took Michael Lewis's class. He was teaching in the fermentation science department, a brewing class. So I took his class, and about the same time I started homebrewing. His class was designed for fermentation science majors. There was no extension at the time or people coming here for brewing, but his classes would teach you, if you wanted to work for Anheuser-Busch, or in fact, Anheuser-Busch came in and recruited from the class.
So did you know even back then that you were going to get into the beer business?
Oh, not at all. I just thought it was something fun, an applied aspect of biochemistry, because most of the people I was going to school with wanted to go to medical school or something like that, and I really wasn't interested in working in a hospital or doing dentistry or anything like that. I was interested perhaps more in research, and so I worked at a lot of labs at Davis, just different research labs. I drove buses while I was here, just tried some different things, and took a brewing class.
That was back in about 87 is what you said, right? 86, 87?
Right. It was probably 88 when I started home brewing. And then 89, I took the class. And I graduated from UC Davis in 91.
Now, 87, things weren't quite the same in terms of beer brewing ingredients that we have today, or even knowledge that we have today, right?
Right. Or even stores. I don't know how I found out about this person, but I bought supplies from somebody's garage. You called the guy, left a message. His name was Bud. He worked in fermentation science department on campus, and he had some supplies in his garage. You'd go there, pick them up. A lot of sugar, a little bit of malt, strange yeast. And I made the beer with my roommates. One of my roommates, I had four of them, but the beer was awful.
My first beer was awful too. I started about 87, and one of the problems, I think, is that there just wasn't the same quality of ingredients that's available today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I read Charlie's book.
I think we all read Charlie's book because I think it was the only book out at the time. Dave Miller had a couple books out, and that was about it.
Right. So we had some kind of all had similar information, but the supplies weren't there. And I probably would have stopped homebrewing based on the flavor. But it was kind of a fun thing to do, so that kept me into it. And then my roommates just drank all the beer really fast. So I really didn't drink much of it because I didn't enjoy it. I thought it should taste more like a commercial beer.
Exactly. So how did that eventually turn into something called White Labs? How'd you eventually turn your passion into a dream here?
Well, I continued on with the idea of research and biochemistry. So I went to UC San Diego, not for San Diego itself, but for the campus and their reputation in biochemistry. It just turned out I went to a nice place to live. And so I went there for biochemistry, and I ended up joining a yeast lab just sort of by accident, but that's where I found my place to do research. So I started making yeast just on the research side, and then became friends with people who just had opened a homebrew mart mm-hmm. in San Diego. And that was probably 92 or yeah, probably 92. And then, so I brought out my equipment out and started homebrewing again. I started all grain brewing with one of the people, Youssef Chenet. And I was really impressed. All of a sudden, the beer was so much better. All grain brewing, and then I started making the yeast for the beer that we did. And then I was really able to get, you know, what I thought was commercial quality beer. So we brewed about 15 gallons every weekend, and they started thinking about beer for a commercial brewery. And I just thought it was something fun to do. I still didn't think about doing a yeast lab probably for a couple more years.
So how hard was it moving from doing 15 gallons on the weekend to actually building a business from scratch?
Yeah, fortunately, I could just do it really slowly because I didn't have a lot of money, and I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But I decided to give White Labs a try because San Diego, I got lucky in that it was a place where a lot of people want to start breweries. So people that I was homebrewing with ended up starting breweries. So it was Ballast Point that got started from Homebrew Mart, but also Pizza Port, Alesmith, Stone, all started that time. So I started making yeast for all of those people. And then when they started their breweries, it was sort of a natural thing for me to start the yeast company and supply them with yeast, and also supply the homebrew store here in San Diego, Homebrew Mart, with yeast. And I would only sell them about 50 vials a week because that's all I could make in the beginning. And they would run out of that in a couple of days.
I saw a huge change. I think it was about 95 that I got my first couple packs of yeast, actual liquid yeast. And man, it made a huge difference in my beer. It was just amazing.
And that's the one thing for the business. I never really had to sell the benefit of liquid yeast because it is more expensive than dry. But we never had to justify it to people because it's so easy to tell when you were homebrewing what a difference it made.
So you got a PhD in this, in biochemistry, obviously, and I'm sure a lot of the folks would be interested in hearing what you have to say about the yeast cycle. What happens when I take my yeast starter and dump it into that beer? What's the next thing that happens?
Well, they want the sugar in the wort. That's what they feed on. And it turns out that beer wort is a great media for yeast because not only does it have sugars that they can eat, it has nutrients that they need. Because they have to do more than just eat sugar. They have to build DNA and protein. So they need some other stuff in there and cell wall material. So beer wort has all that. So they start taking up that material. And so really for a good fermentation, you don't want to just add the yeast and all of a sudden see fermentation activity because you've added too much yeast. There should be a period of hours where we call the lag phase.
Lag phase, yeah.
The yeast absorbs the sugars, they start metabolizing the sugars, then they also bring in minerals, they bring in oxygen, they bring in any fatty acids that might be there. So they start accumulating all these materials, and you want them to make new yeast cells. That's what they're going to do with the sugar.
So then they start reproducing at that point, right?
Right. And so after the lag phase, we call it the log phase growth, because you'll start to see gas production, and that is CO2. In this anaerobic environment. So they're giving off CO2 and it's foaming out. So you'll start to see the foam formation. And then we call that log phase growth because the cells are growing in a logarithmic rate. So they go through this period of very fast growth. One cell divides into about five cells.
Yep.
By creating buds. So you get about five times the amount of yeast out of the fermentation. Now, if you add a whole bunch of yeast at the beginning, it might not grow fivefold.
I see.
So that's going to have an impact. So that's why you want it to kind of grow the right way, because as it grows, it's producing the metabolic byproducts that become the flavor compounds.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeast. It's said that yeast produce over 500 flavor and aroma compounds that are in beer. Many of those are under flavor threshold. but a lot of those are right around flavor threshold. So small differences in the fermentation that lead to a little bit different flavor aroma compound production can impact the beer significantly.
Yeah, I had John Palmer on a short time ago, and he was mentioning that actually he thought that control after you pitch the yeast was more important than what you did before. As far as making good beer, he felt like fermentation control was one of the most important things you could do to take beer from good to great. So what kind of fermentation control would you recommend for an average homebrewer? How could they do better in their fermentation phase?
Yeah, I think I agree with John, and I started calling this the difference between the hot side and the cold side a couple years ago to commercial brewers. And I think it applies just as much to home brewers, that if you could control the aspects on the cold side, once the wort has chilled, you can make good beer out of a lot of starting ingredients if you have good fermentation. Whether it's dry malt or liquid malt or all grain, the beers can be really nice with a good fermentation. And one of the ways to have a good fermentation is to have the right amount of yeast, but also have the right temperature. Temperature control is something that commercial brewers can control really easily because the fermenters are designed with a small amount of cooling that goes around the outside of the fermenter. So they can dial it in really within a degree. And as the fermentation creates heat, you know, more cooling comes on the fermenter, but it's still a very gradual way to give the cooling on the outside of the fermenter. So homebrewers kind of struggle to get that same kind of temperature control. We put the fermenter in a refrigerator, which has a lot of cooling power blowing on the fermenter, and you get big spikes up and down. Or we don't even put it in refrigeration at all. And, you know, the difference between 75 degrees and 68 degrees feels like nothing to us, but it's a big difference on yeast cells. They'll ferment faster at 75, creating more flavors that you might not want in the beer. So temperature control would be my big thing, I think, to homebrewers, that the more they can figure out a way, I think we'll be doing temperature control 5 years from now a different way than we're doing it right now.
So how important is a yeast starter during this initial phase? Obviously, you said earlier you can't pitch too much yeast, but obviously you got to have enough yeast in there. How important is a yeast starter to getting started?
Well, you can pitch too much, but that's if you're repitching, you know, because the yeast grows fivefold in the fermenter. So if you just use that same amount of yeast the next time, you'd actually be starting with five times more. And some people do that. But when you're starting with a smaller amount of yeast and you're making starters, things like that, it's a little bit harder to repitch. I mean, it's harder to add too much yeast. So a starter is a nice way to activate yeast, bring it out of kind of hibernation when it's in a package, make sure that it's working right, it almost proofs the yeast. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, it depends on what kind of package you're starting with. Right. You know, a starter could be just called a propagation in a commercial brewery. And it really depends, you know, how many cells per mil and how much total volume you have, whether you even need a starter. So a lot of people don't do starters, and the beer's the same as tastes the same as somebody who did do a starter. But doing the starter can ensure that you're not going to have fermentation problems. But you also have to make sure you don't introduce more problems in doing a starter, such as contamination.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a little bit of risk to it, but not a lot. If you have the same sanitation practices you do with the beer and you don't have contamination on the beer, you shouldn't have contamination with the starter. But whenever you're working with smaller amounts of volume, smaller amounts of yeast, you have a higher potential for contamination. So you do have to be pretty careful.
So what size starter would you recommend for say an ale, say a 5-gallon batch of ale, which is pretty typical for a home brewer?
Yeah, there's pitching rates between ales and lagers typically, but lagers, a lot of people do similar ones. But
lagers about double, right? Typically,
the volume, if say you're starting from one of our yeast packages or Y yeast, or you know, a lot of the homebrew packages are, I guess, about the same in terms of the amount of yeast. You could pitch it directly, and you're already in the millions of cells per mil, so you're going to have a fermentation that works well. If you do a starter, you could put it into a 500 mils, a pint, almost a pint, or a liter or 2 liters, and you're going to have different speeds of fermentation. The bigger volume you put the starter in, the shorter that lag phase will be.
I see.
But as long as the lag phase is within 10 to 12 hours or 15 hours, that's still acceptable. But if you do a 2-liter starter, that lag phase may be 4 hours. If you do a 500 mil starter, that lag phase may be 6 hours.
I see.
But that doesn't actually impact the, in most studies, you see that it doesn't really impact the final gravity and or the fermentation time. After about 2 or 3 days, they catch up. But it is nice. Some people like seeing a shorter lag time.
So with a typical start, while we're on the topic of starters, what do you recommend for adding oxygen to the wort? Now, obviously, when you boil the wort, it eliminates mostly oxygen in it. Do you think it's important to oxygenate it or aerate your wort before you launch into fermentation?
I think so. You know, aeration and yeast count kind of go together. The less yeast you add, you kind of have to add more oxygen to get the same result. Because the oxygen will allow you to get more yeast growth.
Right.
So if you don't aerate, you really need more yeast. And the big benefit of aeration is to generate new yeast cells that you can use to repitch later. So if you're not repitching, you also might have less of a need for aeration. But yeast want, for good fermentation, yeast want 10 parts per million oxygen, which is the saturation of oxygen in wort. And if you just shake your wort, you're going to get about 2 or 3 parts per million.
Really?
So you're only about a quarter there. So to really get the commercial levels of dissolved oxygen and an optimal fermentation, you need to add in...
you talk about pure oxygen.
Sterile oxygen.
Yeah, pure oxygen.
Yeah, or you can use...
you can do it with air in an aquarium pump too, right?
But exactly. You just have to have a longer contact time.
Yeah, and I think you only get... Typically, that gets to about 8. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Roughly?
Mm-hmm.
It's to
Which
about 8.
Which is still a lot better than 2.
Yeah, obviously much better than 2.
And you need about an hour contact time with an aquarium pump, where with aeration with an oxygen tank, it can be 30 seconds to a minute.
And if I recall, you want to do that before you pitch the yeast, right? It's important that you don't aerate it afterwards.
Because as soon as the yeast are added to the wort, they start doing their work. So you want the oxygen already in there.
Yeah, makes sense. So obviously you want to aerate your wort and then pitch the yeast and then, of course, control the temperature after that.
Right.
So I noticed you had some new product strains out. Can you talk about those? What's the latest from White Lab?
Well, we try to add a few new strains each year. So for 2011, we have a few strains coming out in the Platinum program, which is 2 to 3 different strains every 2 months. And one is a Berliner Weiss blend.
Mm-hmm.
One is a Belgian lager yeast. And then an American farmhouse blend. So that has some Saison yeast and some Brettanomyces, and that's with permission from Tommy Arthur of Lost Abbey Brewery. It's a culture we do for them, but we're also going to make it available in the homebrew vials.
Interesting. So is the American lager a variation on the Belgian Saison? Or is it a totally different style?
The farmhouse?
Yeah, you said the American farmhouse, exactly.
Right. It is. It's with some Brettanomyces in it. So it's going to have
a little bit of
Saison characters and Brettanomyces.
Fantastic. Yeah. That'd probably be pretty interesting, I would think, in a farmhouse ale.
Yeah. Yeah, it gives a lot of complexity and dryness.
Now, I understand you also have a new book released. And the book is Yeast, The Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation. Can you tell us a little bit about that book? It's been out for about a month now.
Yeah, it's been published by Brewers Publications, which is Brewers Association, AHA, all that same group. And we released it at the Great American Beer Festival. I co-wrote it with Jamil Zanishev.
Yep.
And I worked on that for a few years, and it was going kind of slowly. And so I've been in the Davis area for the last year or so. So Jamil lives close to here. So we started working on it. He came in and helped on it and really rewrote a lot of the book, because I had it as kind of a collection of different topics. So the way the book looks now is much different than it looked about a year ago. But it was a big project.
Yeah.
And because we tried to talk about yeast to home brewers and commercial brewers.
So you're really targeting both markets with the book then.
Right. So that's a little tricky because
I would imagine,
you know, home brewers and commercial brewers, different. It's not only just different sizes, it's different equipment. It's different yeast results, different terminology, such as starters. A commercial brewer doesn't use that word. They might know of it because they came from home brewing,
yeah,
but it doesn't come up in the commercial, terminology, language. So we had to address a lot of those things. At first I had wine and distilled spirits in there too, such as whiskey.
Oh, wow.
But when I decided on Brewers Publications, I took that out and it simplified the book quite a bit. But I was trying to write a book that would cater, you know, talk to all the people doing fermentation with yeast, because I viewed this as a yeast user's guide. You know, not so much a biology book. Those are already out there, but real practical things of how do you use yeast to make beer in a fermentation? How do you store it? How do you grow it? What's its life cycle? And so the two main sections are fermentation section, mm-hmm, and then yeast handling section. Mm. And those can be, sometimes you have to kind of wonder, is this a yeast handling question or is it a fermentation question? So we've juggled a lot where to put different topics and try not to repeat things too many times.
Right.
Because that's easy to do when you're talking about fermentation too. Things you might talk about the stationary phase of fermentation, but things you already talked about in some other phase.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on the Beersmith Show today. I really appreciate you taking the time from your busy schedule.
Thank you.
And again, my guest today was Dr. Chris White, president of White Labs at whitelabs.com and co-author of the new book, Yeast: The Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation. I want to say a few words about the book. I was able to read it in the week or two that happened after this interview, and Chris just did an outstanding job with this book. Part one is about the importance of yeast and fermentation. Part two is on biology, enzymes, and esters. Part three is how to choose the right yeast. Part four talks about fermentation. Part five, yeast growth, handling, and storage. And part six is your own yeast lab made easy. And in each of these parts, they walk through in a lot of detail about how to not only manage your yeast, but how to use it in effective beer brewing. And while I'll say the book is not really designed for the rank beginner, it is an outstanding resource for intermediate to advanced brewers who are more interested in learning about what yeast does and how it can affect your beer. So I strongly recommend you pick up that book. It's Yeast, the Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation. And a quick reminder, with the Christmas season coming up, in addition to my book and Chris's book, you might want to also pick up a copy of Beersmith Homebrewing Software from beersmith.com. Beersmith Homebrewing Software is a great way to take the guesswork out of your homebrewing and get started with some great recipes today. Also, I'm looking for your feedback. One idea that I've been toying around with is having a live event in the D.C. area sometime early next year. They'll be in the Washington, D.C. area. And what I was thinking about doing is a live podcast and also a book signing at one of the local microbreweries where we could all get together and have a good time. If you think that's a good idea, leave me a comment at the end of this episode on my blog at beersmith.com/blog. Or you can also leave a comment on our discussion forum at beersmith.com/forum in the podcasting section. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great homebrewing week. Thank you.